Welcome to Take Charge of Your Life, Dare to Pursue Your Dreams, a program designed to give you hope, courage, and inspiration. Our host is Jo Condrell, an award-winning author, businesswoman, and professional speaker who provides training and development programs for some of the country's most respected corporations and government agencies. The show features guests of all ages from all over the world. You'll hear amazing stories from the lives of real people. Now, let's join Jo and her guest.
Welcome to this segment of the Take Charge of Your Life program. Our program today is An Immigrant Living the American Dream with Imran Anwar as our guest. Imran was born in Pakistan, and he is a well-known media figure in the United States. He's done live interviews on CNN, Fox News, Fox and Friends, global TV stations. He's noted as an expert in global business affairs, but he's also an anti-terrorism expert. Imran Anwar, we're delighted to have you with us, Imran.
It's my pleasure to be here.
I see, too, that you have a degree in electrical engineering from the University of Engineering and Technology in Lahore.
Yes, I do.
And you've also attended Columbia Journalism School. So you are certainly a well-grounded individual and a well-known individual.
Well, I thank you for your kind words. I was lucky enough to go to Columbia University for my MBA, business school, and also attended journalism school. So a very lucky man indeed.
I see. Yeah, I think you went on a scholarship, right?
Yes, absolutely. That's, Columbia is pretty expensive for a Pakistani-born a middle-class professional family-based individual to pay directly at Columbia's scholarship. It was an international program, and I was lucky enough to qualify on a competitive scholarship that was available, and I fought very hard for it, and I am fortunate that I got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my interpretation of lucky is preparedness and opportunity, and when those things come together, you happen to be lucky, and I'm
absolutely
lucky.
Absolutely. Luck favors the prepared mind.
Right, and I'm delighted to have you on the show. Would you tell us, at what age did you come to the United States, and had you visited previously? Did you have relatives?
It's kind of interesting. When I finished my Cambridge University O-level and advanced level exams in Pakistan, most of my friends ended up coming to the United States, and some went to England. And at that time, because I did not have the financial resources to come to America, over the years it almost became understood in my mind that if I was going to go to America, it might happen the day, you know, someday when God wills it, not by my own hand or by my own choice. So I had almost given up hope of coming to or visiting America, especially because of the costs involved. I visited as a tourist in 1987 at Christmas time. I was in New York and visited some family here back then. And I remember that as a single Pakistani male, it was very difficult to get visas. And when I was here, many, many people said, Imran, you are so lucky, the Americans, because I was not an American then, the Americans gave you this visa to come to America. As a single male, you have nothing to lose. Just, you know, disappear. Just stay here. And even back then, tempting though that might have been, I made a joke with them, and I said, I hate illegal immigrants. I had seen what Afghan refugees from Afghanistan were doing to Pakistan. So I said, the day I am meant to come to America, the Americans will send me an airline ticket and money. And I didn't know how lucky and how accurate I was. When I got back to Pakistan, there was the paperwork to fill out the, you know, the forms, and I got admitted, and basically, it was an all-expenses-paid scholarship.
Oh, fantastic. And then, after you graduated from Columbia, you stayed on in America?
Actually, absolutely. In 1987, December, Christmas, I spent here, went back, came back in January of 1989. Mm-hmm. And then I went back briefly to take care of some business there and some family obligations, etc. But I kept an address here, kept my presence here.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have been back for good, basically since 1989, obviously, but counting the time I spent there, maybe a few years have been spent in, you know, months at a time or years at a time. But America has been home since January of 1989.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier the effects of illegal immigration that you had seen in your own country. Would you talk just a little bit about that?
Absolutely. If you remember, most American listeners and will not remember that in 1979, it was the Russian Soviet Union, actually, that invaded Afghanistan, trying to basically find their way to the warm seaports of Pakistan. At that time, President Bush Sr. Was vice president, actually, under Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan took a stand. The United States funded and created the Mujahideen, unfortunately, who turned into the Taliban because of our walking away from them. But basically, that left 5 or 6 million illegal Afghan refugees living on the streets and in camps in Pakistan. And much that I like the idea of a humanitarian action for them, mm-hmm. fact of the matter is it brought drugs and weapons onto the streets of Pakistan, which made Beirut look like a walk in the park.
Oh, my goodness. So you've lived that life, and so you determined that when you came to America, essentially, as you said, your way would be paid and you would have a substantial place in American life.
Right, and don't get me wrong. I was already an electrical engineer when I visited, so I could easily have found a way without having to drive a cab to find a job or even to, you know, most people probably buy illegal papers. My point was, why build something on a lie? Why build mm-hmm. something which is based on an illegal action? I think today our culture, our American society, unfortunately, seems to be learning the lesson and teaching the lesson to our younger generations is that you have to lie to get ahead and you have to be a crook to be successful and then not take responsibility. Everybody from people at Computer Associates, Enron, you name it, whatever company you want to name, these are the companies that show that people at the top would rip off the people below them and the stockholders. And the whole excuse was, I didn't know what was going on, but I was making $100 million to not know.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to have a job like that if you have one.
Yes, but as you say, you would be building on a false premise. And,
absolutely, but I wouldn't go to jail. I'll make sure that my jet is always fueled and ready.
But let's say it goes to a core value and to ethics as opposed to an easy getaway and whether you can get away with it or not.
Actually, no, I'm only being facetious.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is people who are doing these things get carried away by the hubris, which is that I will not get caught. And secondly, what happens is that there are others, actually, believe it or not, who do a bit of mental math. Okay, I am defrauding the stockholders and the market or whoever and investors of $200 million. I will be fined $20 million or $30 million and be put to sent to jail for 5 years. That's, you know, $40 million per year payment. Some people are willing to do that.
Yes, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, and that is the lesson we are teaching our young kids and our young professionals, and that is a tragedy because on the one hand, we are being beaten up on the sciences by my fellow Asians from India and Pakistan and now the Russians and the Chinese, etc., in computer programming. But even in medicine, etc., you will soon have telemedicine where you could be talking to a doctor in Pakistan on my system. You could be talking to a secretary who is in Pakistan or India or the Philippines. So eventually, we will be faced, we will pay the price of a very simple fact that people should realize. In 2006, we in America graduated more people in massage therapy than we did in electrical engineering. So as somebody said, we are sure to become the massage capital of the world.
Which is not a very high-paying job with advancement opportunities, is
and
it?
I bet you that the Thai massage parlors could beat us on price.
It's the location, location, location
exactly.
adage that comes in there. Well, I believe that people like you can certainly give us an example in living an honorable life and creating for ourselves a community, not just a life, but a community that has core values that speaks to who we are as a nation, as our forefathers built this nation on honesty, integrity, and principles. How is it that you can, as an honest individual coming to this country, granted you had an education, how do you insert yourself into the commerce of the United States and make it? You're super successful. You may be said to be rich and famous.
Well, I'm still waiting on that one. but quite frankly, I mean, I don't want to make it sound like I am some Mother Teresa or Father Teresa type figure. I have my flaws. I'm a very ordinary human being. The fact of the matter is that society today is made up of, if you look at the surveys that have been done, almost everybody admits to lying. In the good old days, we're told that nobody lied. That's really not true because I think people have been lying since Adam. The problem is that most entrepreneurs who are successful can look back in their life and say, at this or that stage, they will have had to lie. Now, which would be not an honorable thing to do. But the sad fact of the matter is, you're starting a small company and your client says, can you do this? And you have to say yes, even if you fear that you may not. If a client says, have you done this type of work before, you know that you will not get the contract if you say, no, this is going to be the first time. So entrepreneurs, et cetera, will be forced to say, yes, I have. I've done this several times. So the sad thing is that reality-wise, having to stretch the truth, for example, or to play the game, et cetera, that became, and especially in a competitive economy where we are not just competing with our fellow Americans and fellow entrepreneurs, but competitive entrepreneurs in China, Pakistan, India, the Philippines, Russia, you name it, they're competing with us.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes even harder to do the honorable thing all the time. So lest our listeners and our audience seem to think that a Mother Teresa-like or some sainthood-like level of honesty is required, which can almost guarantee them not success but failure in the economic sense, the point is you do what it takes to make your business successful with the caveat that you are not selling your soul, that you are not harming the interests of others. Yes, sure, if you get a contract and you do a good job, you have probably hurt the other guy who was bidding for that contract. But assuming he was playing the same game, as long as you are not saying, hey, I know how to control air traffic over Long Island with these jumbo jets flying around, give me the job. As long as you are not doing something that will lead to the destruction of the pensions of Enron employees, as long as you are not a CEO of a big technology company on Long Island that would go out and simply buy other companies to shut down their operations and just get the product, you know. You knew you were laying off thousands of people, but you did not care. Those are the things as a start. Let's, as a society, start making a promise to ourselves. We will not do these evil things. And then, God willing, in 10 years, in 20 years, in our personal lives and our life as a society, we would get to the stage where we will not lie in a business deal, and maybe in 100 years we get to the stage where we do not lie at all. So Rome was not built in a day. Heaven cannot be achieved in a day. You do not have to be Mother Teresa. You can start with some basic commitments to yourself that I will be true to my own values, and these are my values. Most people do not have that simple conversation with themselves, and that's what leads us into the positions we are in.
Thank you. That's very enlightened, and I agree with you. We can't just be Mother Teresa, but we must live up to our promises. If we say we can do something,
absolutely,
we need to follow through, and maybe we don't have that capability at this moment, but we can subcontract, we can build it up so that we can produce what we say we can produce.
Absolutely.
How do you tie that in with the illegal immigrant situation that we have in America today that's been, well, it's been off the front page now for a little while, but it still is an enormous problem.
Absolutely. Don't get me wrong. I am an immigrant. I am a foreign-born American. I am a person of color in the sense that I am not your blue-eyed, white male. The fact of the matter is this country was built by hardworking people, and many of our existing Americans, black and white,
mm-hmm.
Brown and other colors, may not be working as hard as our forefathers did, or especially the previous generation did. Yet, the fact of the matter is, if we have a law that says it is illegal to come into this country illegally, or it is a crime to come into this country illegally, I cannot stand when our elected leaders upholding the Constitution of the United States and supposedly protecting our interests say, oh, there's just too many of them. There's 11 million of them. Oh, Jesus, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That means that is giving incentive to them to say, send 11 million more illegals over because then America won't be able to do anything.
Yes,
and then I turn around and say to them, suppose this was 11 million members of Al-Qaeda sworn to uphold bin Laden and his values. Would we not line up ships to, take them out of the country and shoot them in? No. Or would we say, oh, it's only 11 million Al-Qaeda members. Let's become the United States of Al-Qaeda. Which one would we be? We would do the right thing. We would say, get rid of the people who are destroying this country. And breaking the laws, walking across the border of a country, and simply going in there to get either on welfare or to get jobs that Americans would do at lower wages that Americans can afford to do. There might be jobs that I would be able to do for you if you said, Imran, I have this little thing that needs to be done. And I say, you know what, it's going to take 5 hours. And, you know, heck, I'll take $20 for it, even though I don't need the money. But $100, I'll go buy a dinner for somebody. On the other hand, if you said, do it for $3, I will laugh in your face. Even if I'm not skilled, I will laugh in your face. Because the time that it will take me to do that task is actually going to be time that is not spent doing something more productive with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are able to do those jobs. And guess what? That causes more depression of our wages, and that causes more pressure on our economy, especially while the legal people here are paying taxes to fund the very system, which includes the healthcare, the social services, etc., that these illegal immigrants come and overburden, and you and I pay the price as our country becomes the next ghetto of the North American continent.
Mm-hmm. You made a good point in that having other illegal immigrants come into America, where then we cannot discriminate from one illegal immigrant or another.
Exactly.
And give them unequal treatment. And so what's good for one, perhaps from Mexico, would also be good for an Al-Qaeda or another.
Well, Joe, a quick point on that we do have some discriminatory policies. For example, people from Cuba can come in with that wet foot, dry foot. I mean, that's the stupidest law I've ever heard, where if they have one foot on land and one foot in the water, you're supposed to allow them to stay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do the Mexicans do? Do they bring a pail of water with them, keep one foot in the water? You know? So then my question is, if a member of Al-Qaeda goes to Cuba first and then comes from there, is he Al-Qaeda or is he Cuban and that's protected by that law? I mean, these are stupid laws.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I know that when in the September 11, we were attacked by 19 Saudis and Kuwaiti Arabs, 19 Saudi Arabs, yet we punished many, many illegal Muslim immigrants from Pakistan and India and Bangladesh by deporting them simply because they were Muslim. Now, they're illegal and I have no sympathy for them, but I cannot stand when we do these one-sided things. The problem I have with the 11 million example is, doesn't that give the Chinese incentive to drop off 11 million Chinese? Believe me, they got plenty to export.
Mm-hmm.
Out there.
Mm-hmm.
They can send 11 million Chinese on ships on the border with Canada somewhere, and these guys either just swim ashore in New York. What are we going to do? Aren't the Chinese as hardworking or more hardworking than the Mexicans? Will that excuse still apply? Don't the Chinese learn about this? Actually, the Chinese learn more English even with their accents than the Mexican and the illegal immigrants try to do coming in from the south. So I would prefer to have the Chinese. The Chinese are generally more likely to open nail salons, work in computer industry, you know, open a restaurant, than do grass mowing or something. So again, they will add themselves or insert themselves into society at a higher level than those from the south. So again, I'm not beating up on Mexico, but my point is, if I had a choice to pick 11 million immigrants illegal immigrants, I would pick them from China and India. Maybe some of them will be doctors, some of them will become, you know, shopkeepers and whatnot, as opposed to farm workers, etc. And so this country has completely, completely walked away from looking out for its own interests, and the worst cancer that we are suffering from is our own Congress and elected leaders who only want to see how to give amnesty so that they can get more votes.
Well, I agree with you that our laws definitely need to be refined, revised, so that the laws are applying to today's issues and today's events, occurrences. And I think one of the keys that we're looking at in the differences in the immigrants that come to the United States, legal or otherwise, is their willingness to assimilate into the American culture and to become an American, as opposed to their intent to be what they were before, but taking advantage of the American system.
Absolutely. I think one of the greatest things you can do is, even to other immigrant groups, I always say, remember and take pride in your heritage. Remember to, even if you get married to an American in the United States, you're likely to have American kids,
mm-hmm.
Even though they may be mixed culture, mixed race, etc. They learn the English language. But teach them your native language. take them to your visit your ancestral land when they're 7 years old and 11 years old so that they know where they came from. Mm-hmm. Take pride in that. Mm-hmm. Speak your own old language in the home at least, but also make sure you assimilate. So what is happening is I cannot stand people from Pakistan or Mexico or India or any other country who come and create their little replicas of their own original countries. And I am a Muslim, Pakistani-born Muslim, and I say to my Pakistani-born and other Muslims, fine, you want to cover your head when you're going out? Nobody's forcing you not to. But if you find this bad American culture so evil, because there's Playboy magazine on sale at the newsstands, and Sex in the City used to be a big show on TV, etc., you know what? If you don't like America the way it is, sure, you try to improve it a little bit at a time. You want crime to go down. You want pollution to go down. You want stupid people to be run out of office in Washington. But if you are looking to replicate your previous country here, why did you leave your previous country? If it was such a great hotshot place, why did you just go back? And that applies to Pakistanis, Indians, Chinese, and anybody else.
That's a good point. Let's talk a little bit about how you became a media expert. How is it that you are able to do things that Americans seem unable to do? And even, like you mentioned earlier, the cab drivers and such, we have people on welfare who might be driving cabs and elevating themselves. Why is it that someone from India or Pakistan comes in and gets those jobs and moves up in the society when our native-born people sometimes don't seem to grasp that?
I had an excellent interview with a journalist out of Washington on that very topic last week, and the point I mentioned was that when I look around, and I actually have known native-born Americans of different sort of ethnic groups complain about how immigrants steal their jobs, and I have always asked them, I said, don't get me wrong, I am against illegal immigrants and all that stuff. However, when did you last check the requirements to become a cab driver? A Pakistani comes from Pakistan or an Indian from India and barely speaks the English language, does not know where Brooklyn or Queens are, has never owned a car in Pakistan, much less driven on the right side of the street, so to speak, as, you know, we drive on the opposite side from the English system of India and Pakistan, mm-hmm. yet they become hardworking cab drivers, eventually buying their own medallion. Now, what of the requirements of the Taxi and Limousine Commission have a rocket science degree that you have to know propulsion systems to be able to operate a taxi, that you living in the inner city, up in the Bronx or down in parts of Brooklyn or Queens or even in New Jersey or whatever, that you could not do? When the Koreans come and open nail salons, as a large number of them do, or delis, for example, where does it say that you will have a degree in chemical engineering or biomedical products that they have and that you could not get? These are businesses that anybody with a brain, two working hands, or even I have seen one person who has one, who was disabled, running that business, and God bless them. You know, it's such an inspiration. So it is time that we got over this politically correct BS of saying, oh, we can't talk about this because people feel that they were, you know, their ancestors were taken advantage of in 200 years ago. Well, guess what? As a Pakistani, 60 years ago, my grandfather and his family were being taken advantage of, quote, by the same white man who may have taken advantage of somebody's great-grandfather 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That does not stop Indians and Pakistanis from being one of the most potent forces in transportation, in hoteling, in Silicon Valley as engineers and software programmers. So what is it? It's simply a hunger. An immigrant has a sense of hunger, a sense of needing to make it because he had burnt all his bridges or he left everything behind. There is nothing to go back to. He has to succeed here. Whereas people here will say, I have a sense of entitlement. This is beneath me. This is, I don't want to do this. This is too much work. And that actually pervades both the lower economic circles, for example, the inner cities, as much as the middle and upper middle class educated families, which is why we have more kids graduating in exercise therapy and massage than in electrical engineering. How do we expect to send man to the moon again, much less to Mars, if we basically cannot even get out of our massage bed?
Mm-hmm. We need a sense of urgency, wouldn't you say? We need to get back to, I can do this. It may be hard work, and hard work is not bad language.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think not only have we lost that, I'll give you one example. When I was going to school in Pakistan, and even when my siblings were going to school, when we were sent to school on the school bus or dropped off or whatever by our parents, I always recall being work hard, mm-hmm. pretty hard, as the farewell that was said to the kid,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the thing I see on TV when kids are dropped off at school, and as I have seen my neighbors and all do, have fun, have fun. I'm sorry, I never equated school with fun in my best of dreams. Okay, and unless it was the school of massage therapy and you were working on the Swedish bikini team or something, but then I, you know, signed me up for that. But quite frankly, and seriously, the fact of the matter is that there are people who feel that, and believe me, I live a fun life. I'm living the American dream more than many Americans aspire to or even try to. I work very, very hard for it, but at the same time, I enjoy the rewards of it very much too. But it is, you invest in school. You don't enjoy in school. You invest in school in hard work, so you live up to, you live a good life later. Or you invest in the hard work to set up a business. Or you invest in learning with hard work how to speak English and drive a cab or start a newspaper kiosk or whatever, so that you can later have your own grocery store, for example. And so those are the things that immigrants do and our people don't. And the sense of urgency that you talk about, Joe,
mm-hmm.
we need to have an urgent sense of urgency. And allow me to illustrate what I'm talking about. The World is Flat is a very popular book. Everybody talks about it, with Friedman from the New York Times writing, you know, how the world has basically flattened and basically everybody is able to compete with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, not only have we looked at that and said, that's interesting. What we need to realize is that we urgently need to start playing in that level playing field now while we are having higher cost of doing business and a higher cost of living. Yes, we enjoy a higher standard of living, but we also pay a higher price for it. Most people would not be able to survive on $8,000 a year, for example, like somebody in China or India could. However, the rate of change around us is accelerating. It's not just that the rate of change is high. The rate of change is accelerating, and hence the actual change will be exponentially fast, which means we need to urgently feel urgency. Otherwise, we will not even be able to keep up with the coattails of the change that is coming upon us.
That's an excellent thought. I was doing an interview with a gentleman in Singapore just recently, and this morning I had a gentleman from Algeria come on to communicate with me on my computer. And we need to realize that American shores and the oceans each side of us don't protect us from the world anymore. Our world is totally different. Now, I see a lot of parents who worked really hard to make it in their life and to get a substantial way of life now, turning to their children and wanting their children simply to enjoy life, so the children never have the opportunity to learn the value of hard work and to learn how to make a life for themselves and compete in the marketplace. And that's, I think, where we're falling behind a lot.
Absolutely. Joe, even if massage prices go up to $250 an hour, the problem is that all these graduates of exercise therapy today will be thinking, well, I can make $100,000 with, you know, $200 per hour massages, just like a lawyer makes $175 an hour and can enjoy $100,000 life without any problem. My problem and my question to them is, who is going to pay you that money? Are you going to go give a massage to a Russian tycoon in Moscow? No. Eventually, if your society, and this is a message to my politicians, to our politicians, to people who are listening, eventually, yes, manufacturing is passé. It is outsourced decades ago. But in the long run, a country that does not produce something will not have money. And if it does not have money, it cannot enjoy the enjoyments of life that the parents or the people would like to do. You cannot just have yeah, I can become a rock star, you know, with my Tom Cruise looks. No, I don't think so. The fact of the matter is, yes, I can dream of becoming a rock star or a basketball star. Sure, I might be one in 10,000 who even gets to play on one of the teams. Guess what? Even if I was getting paid $10 million a year to play in a basketball game because people are paying $100 per seat to fill those arenas, mm-hmm. how long will that go on? People have to have jobs that pay them $50,000 to $150,000 a year to be able to go attend a basketball game. A family going to a tennis match, for example, can expect to spend a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, if those families are not making that money, who is going to buy those arena seats? Who is going to pay the basketball players? Who is going to go to the rock concert to make, you know, the new bands rich? We are not producing anything at the core that the rest of the world wants, except, sure, music, etc. And in the old days, we were also producing things like computers, where we were making the technology. The Chinese or the Taiwanese were assembling it. But guess what? It is the kind of thing that they have started designing now. And companies that used to be contract manufacturers for American computer makers, a company named Acer, for example,
mm-hmm.
is actually selling that stuff by its own brand. Lenovo, who used to do the work for IBM, the biggest computer name in history, they have actually bought out IBM's computer business. So in the long run, we cannot be a service-based society because the people we will be serving amongst ourselves, how are they going to pay us? Unless we go back to the barter system. Hey, Joe, I can scratch your back. Can you scratch mine? Oh, okay. So then how did we make any money doing that?
We make a living, perhaps, but not a life. That's interesting because we are in the information age, and if we aren't keeping up with our studies, our learning of events in the world, how are we going to be leaders in the world? We need to really emphasize that people can take charge of their lives at a very early age and begin to envision where they'll be 5 or 10 years from now. The world is rapidly changing, and unless you're on the internet, and now, unless you have an iPod, unless you have a cell phone, you're nobody. You're nowhere. You can't get that information. So what we're saying, what I understand you saying, we need to get down to basics. We need to, as a community, as a nation, relearn the value of hard work, of studying, of learning, of growing in our own lives. What else would you like to say to anybody who's listening? What would be your message to an American who's looking for a job, who's trying to get started in American life, work life?
A couple of things I would definitely say. America is still the land of greatest opportunity compared to any place on the planet, on any planet at least that I know of, even if it's 9 planets or 12, it's still up for debate, as you know. But seriously, America is and will be a huge land of opportunity for a long time to come. But you need to know what you want to do with your life. If you don't know where you're going, you will not get there. And it is never too late. Even if you did not get a start early in life, this is the one country in the world where you can go to medical school when you're 60 years old. You can go to business school when you're 50 years old. You can start a new business when you're 70 years old. You can play tennis when you're 80 years old, for God's sakes. This is the country where you can do anything, but that requires getting off that part of our body that is popularly known as the butt. If you do not know where you want to be, you will not get there. You will basically sit and watch your life and your country's life and society go down the tube, and then it will be too late. So get up and know, I can do it. That's your motto. If anyone can do it, I can do it. That's my personal motto. I use that all the time. And then know what you want to do. Again, know what you want to do, and if you really want to shake yourself out of whatever state of mind you are in, sit down today with a piece of paper and write your own either obituary or something that will be read out at an eulogy that will be read out the day you are no longer alive. See what you want to be said for yourself. Write that down. See how you want to be remembered. Write down your eulogy and then see how to make those things happen that you want to be mentioned in your eulogy. Believe me, if you don't have an end in sight, if you do not have an end in mind, you will never even get started. And that's the way to do it. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, but knowing what the destination is. Set a destination. Start with your first step today.
Excellent advice. take the time to sit down, think about what you want in life, write it down, and then take that first step toward that achievement of that dream. You have resources, tremendous resources, on the internet, in your community, in your library. Talk to people. A conversation across the table with a wise man is worth years of studying in the books. So find a mentor, find someone. Imran, I really thank you for sharing your thoughts with us today. You are a most interesting person who will have a definite impact no matter where you are in the world. And we're happy that you're here in the United States among us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor. It's a privilege. And I am a proud American. Love everything about my life that America enables me to do. And I hope I can work hard enough to get to the other 90% of my potential that I have not reached.
We look forward to hearing from you much more in the future and to seeing you on television as well.
Thank you so much.